Counsel, this is the case of State versus Johnson, and we will begin this morning by having the members of the court introduce themselves. I'm Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice, and by order of seniority on the court, the other members of the court will now introduce themselves.
Good morning. This is Justice Lindsay Miller Lerman.
William Castle.
Morning, Stephanie Stacy.
Good morning, Jeff Funk.
Jonathan Papik.
John Frydenberg.
And counsel, Ms. Mendoza, are you with us today?
Yes, I am.
Good morning to you. And Ms. Osborne, are you with us today?
I am.
Very good, counsel. Thank you for participating by WebEx. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin the arguments?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you then. Ms. Mendoza, again, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Allison Mendoza, and I'm an assistant public defender for Douglas County, and I represent the appellant, Thomas Johnson. This appeal arises from Mr. Johnson's conviction after a bench trial in which he was charged with 5 counts of robbery, 5 counts of use of a weapon to commit a felony, assault in second degree, and attempted escape that occurred in 2015. During the pendency of the case, Mr. Johnson vacillated between periods of competency and incompetency in which he was committed to the Lincoln Regional Center several times. Ultimately, it was determined that he needed to remain at the regional center until his trial due to the fact that the medication that he was being prescribed at Douglas County Corrections was insufficient to keep him competent. During the points of competency for Mr. Johnson, motions to suppress challenging out-of-court identifications, as well as a statement Mr. Johnson made to law enforcement shortly after his arrest, were filed and taken up by the district court. The district court denied both those motions, and Mr. Johnson filed a timely notice of intent to plead not responsible by reason of insanity. Finally, in October of 2019, Mr. Johnson waived his right to a jury trial and proceeded to a stipulated bench trial, where the main issue was whether he was not responsible by reason of insanity at the time of the crimes. The issues for the motions to suppress were preserved in the stipulated bench trial. While the appellate brief alleges 4 assignments of error, I would like to use my oral argument to discuss the motion to suppress, specifically his statement, as I feel that a decision by this court on that particular issue could have a lasting significance and ramifications for future cases and for law enforcement's how they continue with interrogations after invocations of rights to counsel. When Mr. Johnson was arrested on that day, he was taken into the Douglas County, I'm sorry, the Omaha Police Department's central headquarters, and it's no question that Mr. Johnson was in custody for Miranda purposes. He was in the fourth floor interview room in custody, and he was given his Miranda rights. It is established in the record as well as in the video that he was given his Miranda rights at approximately 7:52 in the morning. At 7:58, during that time-stamped video, Detective Martin, who was conducting the interview, starts discussing how they think that he's involved in these 5 separate robberies, and that he, as this interrogation is occurring, that there are other detectives that are conducting photo lineups. At 7:58, a mere 11 minutes after Mr. Martin enters and starts the interrogation, Mr. Johnson states, if that's the case, and you all are gonna arrest me and put me in lineup, you can all do that and we can stop talking because I've done nothing wrong. And 5 minutes later, he then continues to say, you want me to do a lineup, go ahead, You want me to do a lineup or put a picture ID and talk, and you want to put me a lineup and you can talk to my lawyer. The district court determined in its order denying the motion to suppress that at that point, Mr. Johnson invokes his right to an attorney and to talk to his lawyer at 8:03.
Counsel, did Mr. Johnson make any incriminating statement during that interview?
It's arguable. Admittedly, yes. Most of the time, he denies it.
What do you suppress?
Well,
what statements?
Well, there are statements later that he talks about his hands. One of the witnesses, I believe it was in response to the Daisy Jones locker robbery, the victim indicates that when she was fighting with the suspect, she starts biting the perpetrator's arm, forearm, and hands. And so Mr. Detective Martin then starts to inquire of Mr. Johnson about marks that he has on his hands. And Mr. Johnson indicates that, yes, he does have marks on his hands, but they're related to, I believe he says it's with some
yard work.
Yes, yard work is what he does. But nevertheless, he does admit that he has recent injuries on his hands. And additionally, when Detective Martin shows a still photograph of Mr. Johnson and says to Mr. Johnson, this is you. This is you in the surveillance photos. Mr. Johnson says, well, it kind of looks like me. The state's brief indicates that that's not really an admission, that, you know, he says he looks like him. But later on in the questioning, Detective Martin says, well, you admitted it. You said that it's you and it looks like you. So, granted, it's not a full confession. Yes, I did it. But there are definitely statements that can be used against Mr. Johnson had he proceeded a different direction with respect to his trial. I guess the thing that I want to highlight is, regardless of whether there was in fact incriminating statements or not made by Mr. Johnson, how law enforcement chose to address his invocation of his right to counsel carries, I think, great import for future cases and for how law enforcement decides to treat invocations of right to counsel.
I beg your pardon. Is it your position that Mr. Johnson invoked his right to counsel at 8:03 when he said, you can talk to my lawyer?
Correct.
And you don't find it ambiguous, is that correct?
I don't. There's no equivocation. There's nothing where he says, I think I should talk to my lawyer. Do I need a lawyer? That this court has further found, can I talk to a lawyer first in Guzman? Or should I have an attorney or probably or might? There's nothing in there that, in my mind, shows an equivocation or ambiguousness. He says, talk to my lawyer.
The trial court evidently assesses that as an invocation of rights and says thereafter there was no questioning. Do you think that's a correct factual finding? There was no further questioning, insofar as you have now remarked on the fact that there was a discussion of the hand and there was further discussion about looks like me, I don't have that shirt.
Well, and I think that's a really good point, Judge Miller-Lerman. Is there express questioning? Arguably no, but I think there's still the functional equivalent of questioning. After he says, talk to my lawyer at 8:03, Detective Martin then goes on to say, well, we're probably going to have to take you down to the jail and book you. You know, we're going to get a search warrant for your house. We're starting to get those witness identifications. And so he goes on to talk and goes on to express to him about how this is his time to fess up. He's not necessarily saying, did you do these things? Is it statements with an express question mark behind it? No. But I do think that they are statements that are the functional equivalent of questioning, in which he's trying to get Mr. Johnson to continue talking. He goes on again to talk about, well, we're going to go get a search warrant. We're going to go look at your house.
What do our cases tell us about statements by law enforcement that don't end with a question mark, but whether they can be interrogation or not? And how does this fit into that doctrine?
Well, I think that this can fall in the line of it's a functional equivalent of questioning, that they're not necessarily questions, again, with the question mark, but that they're statements likely to elicit an incriminating response, and it's a function equivalent of questioning. That's where I think that some of these statements by Detective Martin fall under. And again, it's not, I readily admit that it can be construed in one way, that Mr. Johnson doesn't fess up and say, I did it. It was me. I did all five. But again, I think this case has significant consequence of how law enforcement is supposed to honor a right of invoking his right to an individual's right to an attorney, and how they then choose to finish the process of booking a potential suspect and not crossing over that line with respect to violating a person's right to invoke counsel. Mr. Johnson, I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Your time is up, Ms. Mendoza, so thank you very much. Ms. Osborne, again, good morning to you, and you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellee of the state of Nebraska. After a partially stipulated bench trial, appellant was found guilty of several offenses related to a series of robberies in 2015, where he was armed with a knife. Evidence was adduced that appellant had since admitted to his crimes and asserted that he was not guilty by reason of insanity. There are several issues on appeal. Appellant has focused her comments to the statements to police. I will do the same unless there are further questions from the court as to any other issues. Otherwise, I'll submit on the brief on those. I'll begin then with the statements to police. Regarding those statements, appellant concedes he was fully advised of his Miranda rights, and he knowingly and voluntarily waived those rights during his custodial interrogation until he claims to have invoked his right to counsel at 8:03 a.m. However, he asserts that questioning continued in violation of Miranda. The state disagrees that any violation of appellant's right to counsel occurred. This appeal is about whether Johnson invoked his right to counsel and when that would have occurred. After a knowing and voluntary waiver of Miranda rights, law enforcement officers may continue questioning until and unless the suspect clearly requests an attorney, and that involves the suspect's invocation of the right to counsel must be unambiguous and unequivocal. This is an objective inquiry. Johnson claims his statement at 8:03 a.m. invoked his right to counsel when he told the detective, if you want to line up with picture ID or talk to my lawyer, whatever, because I ain't done nothing like that, man. The state submits this is not an unambiguous invocation of his right to counsel. It does not meet the legal standard for invoking that right. Even if this court determined that the district court made a legal finding that Johnson invoked his right to counsel at 8:03 a.m., such a finding is reviewed de novo by this court. And while Johnson's statement references an attorney, it was not an unambiguous or unequivocal invocation of his right to counsel. He did not say that he wanted to speak to a lawyer or have one present during questioning. He basically said that the investigator could talk to his lawyer if he wanted to. He didn't say he wanted to talk to a lawyer. Johnson did not invoke his right to counsel until at least 10:27 a.m. When he stated, as a matter of fact, since you're saying I've been charged, can I call my lawyer now then? I guess arguably that might be an invocation, but at that point, all questioning from police had long since ceased. Even assuming without conceding that Johnson's Miranda rights were violated in some way, and the trial court erred in failing to suppress the police interview, any such error was harmless. The admission of an improperly obtained statement is trial error, so it's subject to harmless error analysis. There are two reasons why any error would be harmless. First, Johnson's statements during the interview do not amount to a confession. He made only one statement that could at all be considered incriminating in any way during the entire police interview when he was shown a photo of the robbery suspect from the surveillance video and was asked if that was him. He stated, "It looks like me." He didn't say that it was him, and he immediately attempted to limit the incriminating nature of that statement when he stated that he's always in and out of stores, and he denied knowing, he denied owning any of the clothing that the suspect was wearing in that photograph. Essentially, by denying that, he's saying, that's not me. Other than that single statement, he consistently denied involvement in the robberies. He said nothing incriminating. The statement, there was some comment about the injuries to his hands. He denied that that was the result of the victim biting him. He said it was from yard work. The statement about the photograph was cumulative to any other properly admitted evidence at trial, because all that other evidence clearly showed that the suspect in the surveillance video had a strong resemblance to Johnson. I don't think that's denied at all, that the person who committed these offenses had a strong resemblance to Johnson. It's also important to note that that statement occurred at 8 o'clock a.m. The statement about what looks like me, that occurred at 8 a.m. Prior to the time when Johnson claims that he invoked his right to counsel at 8:03. The other reason it's harmless is the other evidence at trial overwhelmingly showed that Johnson committed the offenses. There was surveillance video Johnson in three of the five robberies. All eight eyewitnesses identified Johnson as the robber from all five of the robberies. Johnson's own family members, five of his own family members who were in-law family members, including his wife, contacted or had contact with the police and identified Johnson as the robber from photos taken from the surveillance video of two of the robberies. A search warrant resulted in police finding clothing at Johnson's residence that matched what the robber was wearing during three of the robberies. Johnson had an apparent bite mark on his hand, consistent with the report of one of the victims who had bit the suspect. And I think an important thing to also recognize is that Johnson later admitted to committing all of the robberies during his two insanity evaluations. He provided details of each of the offenses. So even assuming that his statement was somehow inadmissible, when viewed relative to the properly admitted overwhelming evidence of his guilt, there is no reasonable probability that the district court's verdict was attributable to any erroneous admission of Johnson's statement. I'd also like to add, and I don't think it's mentioned in the state's brief, but this was a trial, and Nebraska has case law that in reference to how it's reviewed when it's a bench trial, the appellant showed that the trial court actually made a factual determination or otherwise resolved a factual issue or question through the use of the erroneously admitted evidence because of the presumption that the trial court sitting as a fact finder disregards inadmissible evidence. So this court has previously stated that the appellant must show that the trial court made a finding of guilt based exclusively on the erroneously admitted evidence. If there's other sufficient evidence to support the finding of guilt, the conviction will not be reversed. Appellant can't make that showing in this case.
Counsel, at trial, did appellant make an election to pursue a defense of actual innocence, or did the appellant pursue only the insanity defense?
The appellant pursued the insanity defense. The appellant preserved the motion to suppress on those two issues, but the defense at trial was not responsible or not guilty by reason of insanity. The evidence at trial clearly indicates that he has since admitted to committing all of the offenses, and he's provided specific details of his offense conduct. So I don't think there's a dispute factually that he did commit the offense. I don't know. The district court made a factual finding that the evidence was sufficient. All of the evidence, the police reports, all of the exhibits that were admitted.
Were any of the appellant statements used against him in the evaluation of the insanity defense by the court? Can we tell from the record?
I don't believe that the record would indicate that any of you're referring to statements in the police interview.
Yes, I'm sorry. The interview in question.
I don't believe they were used as part of the insanity defense. The written verdict, essentially by the district court, the findings on insanity are exclusively limited to the insanity evaluations and the competency evaluations and the testimony of the two psychiatrist witnesses. There's nothing contained in the verdict that refers to the police interview as having been considered at all in the determination of sanity or insanity. It's not referenced at all. So unless there are further questions from the court, I'd ask this the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. I don't believe we have time for rebuttal. That is correct. There is no time for rebuttal. So, counsel, thank you to both of you for participating on WebEx. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is In Re Interest of Prince R. And counsel, you are. Thank you again.
Thank you.